Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
And gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Griese! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
And hello once again. This is Coach Chuck Griese with another week of American Tennis. We always say that our mission of American Tennis is to give you a forum and a platform to stand up and to speak out and say those things that you want to say, especially now when we need your voice so very, very much. To stand up and speak out about some of the things good, some of the things not so good that are going on in American tennis. We are the UR Tennis Network, the letter U, the letter R, the number 10, and the letter S network. Every week, the UR Tennis Network brings you five great shows. John Denise's high school Florida program right now is a great one, and go to his program on Thursday afternoons, I believe at 5 o'clock Eastern Time. Lisa Stone's Parenting Aces program continues to be a hit show, and she does a fantastic job as well with her blogs and her writings as well. 2 hours from right now, Jason Haynes, the originator and the founder and CEO of the UR Tennis Network, will bring you the College Connection with a great college coach on, and great information for you that are trying to find out about college tennis programs. And Steve Clark's West Coast tennis program comes every, I believe it's every Monday on the UR Tennis Network as well. If you want to call in, the call-in number is area code 714-583-6853. That's 714-583-6853. And I wanted to remind all of you that every week, every one of the programs, actually over the past 5 years of the UR Tennis Network, you can bring them up by going to UR Tennis Network, the letter U, the letter R, the number 10, and then the letter S network, UR Tennis Network. You can bring it up on your iPhone or the computer, and you can get every show. You can also listen, folks, every one of my programs over the past 3.5 years now of being the spokesman for American Tennis on the American Tennis program. I'm so proud to have done the program. But go to my website, chuckcriese.net, K-R-I-E-S-E.net, and you can get my writings, my blogs, my books. I started going back into my books that I've written over the years, the four tennis books, and gotten some of the information back out because we've been doing this instructional series on team building today, but other things such as pecking order, momentum control, and some of those things that coaches have asked me to do programs on. But today, folks, this is an instructional series program. We're going to talk about team building in an individual sport. But I don't want to be political out of the blocks. I get off on that tangent sometime. And I always say the stand up, speak out, and stay professional. Address issues, not people. Nobody can find fault with that. You can say what you want to say. Edmund Burke always said his greatest quote is, "All that it takes for evil to prosper is for good men to do nothing, good people to do nothing." We encourage you to stand up, speak out. We certainly need your voices these days. But we want to talk about building a team sport out of an individual, sometimes selfish, sometimes self-centered, sometimes almost always youngsters grow up with tennis being an individual sport, and then we try to get them involved in participation activities with team tennis. And I want to talk about that a little bit out of the blocks, and I want to challenge, again, I'm reaching out here and challenging the USTA. Guys, your website is awful, and God, is that the way to start out? No. I need to just say the website needs much, much improvement. What you need to do is have a branch. When you go to USTA.com, just you ought to have one arrow. It says, hit here for participation activities and participation tennis. The other arrow should go to hit here for competitive tennis and performance events. Then hit here for professional events if you want. But folks, this is so important. If you go to that website, it is a cluster mess up or whatever you want to call it, but it is so hard to navigate through that thing. And I've always, we all know that, but the problem is most tennis players, whether they are recreational tennis players on a 3.5 team or a high school team or something, everybody would like to think that their participation tennis is a competitive event, but the fact is, and the truth is that it is not. There's participation competitive tennis, and there is competitive tennis, where youngsters are trying to get better. Most of the problems that we have, that the USTA has in trying to differentiate these two, and it's not a criticism, guys, it is an observation. You know, USTA guys, don't turn me off, just listen. It's an observation. If you would make one website for participation, one for performance, and make the separation of those two, you could do a much better job. I think that a lot, but everybody coming up thinks they're in the performance part of it, and you are not. I mean, these 3.5 leagues and men's leagues and weekend warrior leagues and 70 and over gold ball events. These are all pretty much participation activities. The performance activities should be our junior events and our professional events, and those events where people are continuing to try to get better. Now, the reason I've used this division to start out with is because we are talking about team tennis and building a team atmosphere in an individual sport. Participation tennis is good and is nurtured by team activities. It's good for teamwork. It's good for learning, having friends in these things. It is not the best way to develop skill sets. Skill tennis, competitive tennis, bringing your player along the fastest, needs to be done with tournament tennis. Competitive tournament tennis allows a player to grow exponentially. In one weekend, they can come into a tournament on a Thursday afternoon, leave Sunday afternoon, 72 hours later, and and they can go to a whole new level of performance based on the fact that the first couple rounds of a tournament, they're usually playing against players that might be lower than their level. The middle rounds are usually those players that are about the same as they are. The semis and finals are the ones that stretch them. But if a player works their way through a tournament with five or six matches in a weekend or a week, I don't guess they allow you to play that many matches in a weekend anymore. Daggone it. You guys are, that's part of Operation Dumb Down, our program, you know, the Project Dumb Down. You know, kids, my golly, my son plays four baseball games and 10 and under baseball in 2 days on the weekend. And, you know, I'm saying, what's wrong with tennis that they can't play more? Different topic here, but I wanted to say that in tournament tennis, you grow exponentially as you win. When you lose, you only fall arithmetically. In other words, you could lose first round, and then the fourth tournament you play, you win, you go to the moon. Most of the time, that's the way it does happen in tournament tennis. In team tennis, however, you only grow arithmetically. If you're playing number four on a six-person team, and you went beat a number four person, beat another four person, beat a number four person, beat a number four person, you only grow arithmetically through each of those wins. It does not stimulate a player to really know where they are. And I would argue that it dumbs down a player's development. And folks, I have coached 1,200 dual matches over the last 40 years. And I'm telling you that I've seen players' careers crushed by growing only arithmetically from wins. However, they fall geometrically, so it's just the reverse. Player development, you fall geometrically when you play team tennis and you're the last person out there and you choke your brains out and you lose to a, I mean, and everybody says, oh, it'll make you tough. No, well, you lose careers. This is a sport where think about how tournaments are. Half of the draw, whether it's 128 or 64 or 32, half of the draw loses the first match. Within the first 2 to 3 hours of the tournament, half of them are out of there. The second day, 3/4, 75% are out of there. By the third day, you only have 12.5% of the players left, and everybody understands that, hey, listen, it's a high roller activity, and we hope we can grow as we're losing. And tournament tennis allows you to only fall arithmetically, but grow exponentially or grow geometrically when you play tournament tennis. Team tennis does the reverse. So my point again is that we have a individual sport with some team opportunities, but guys, it is a participation opportunity. I wish that high school tennis, if you look at tennis in Texas, high school tennis in Texas is a great model. They play team tennis in the fall, individual tennis in the spring, and they have the best of both worlds. I wish that we would have a system like Coach Randy Blumendahl has recommended in one of his papers that he gave last year in full on blind eyes and deaf ears of the ITA. That, you know, the sport of college tennis, he says, should be treated as an individual sport with team opportunity instead of team sport with an individual opportunity. Much like golf and track and field, swimming and diving, tennis is an individual sport. However, our sport of tennis has been marketed for many years as a team sport. This approach has made its packaging and marketing extremely difficult. When people go to a team match, there's no way to put six cameras on six courts and six balls in the air at the same time to make it exciting. It's a good participation sport. Whereas other individual sports have been marketed as individual sports with team opportunity. For example, golf. Golf now is marketed as an individual sport with team opportunity. Until the 60s, golf was a head-to-head match play sport where number one player would play a one, two would play two, three would play three, one 18 hole round of 18 holes. And if you beat the person, you beat them in a match play event. And everybody who watches golf on TV understands that it's much more exciting to see tournaments and see the leaders switch. And you might see somebody come out of nowhere, out of the pack, to become a great golfer that weekend. The hero of the college national event might be the number five player. In tennis, this doesn't happen. The number five player is playing the five person. The number five player in golf might win the whole shooting match, you know, the whole cotton caboodle or whatever they say. But this is really the source of our marketing problem with collegiate tennis. Team tennis is often used as a participation event and not a performance event at other levels. At the college level, this has made popularity and marketing opportunities very random and extremely frustrating. Now, could it be that a greater opportunity might be available if the sport made a simple adjustment to its presentation and not making such dramatic changes in scoring in this hocus-pocus show that the daggone ITA and USTA is pushing forward with this no-ad dumb-down? And this isn't a show about no-ad, but daggone it, that is our problem. USTA, you just need to separate the performance versus participation goals and objectives. And I know that 35-year-old guy who's a weekend warrior would like to think if he just had one more chance on the tour, he could really win a couple 3.5 events on the 35s, and he could be up there with Federer, but it ain't going to happen. It ain't going to happen. It's, you know, the point is those participation events. Team tennis is pretty much like playing best ball in golf. These best ball events, they're just sort of mixers and things like that. We need to separate the two. So right out of the blocks, I wanted to make a clear differentiation between those two things, what team activity and individual participation should be in tennis. Now, look, my daughter's a swimmer, so this is an individual sport with team opportunity, but in the long run, she's doing something quite different than even though she likes the socialization of the team and all those things, doing something quite different than my son, who plays first base on his 10 and under travel ball club, and where the team, it's a team activity and a team sport. You know, so, folks, we want to talk about maximizing today, how to build a team in an individual sport. I'll be right back after our commercials. This is American Tennis with Coach Chuck Creasy.
This is Coach J.P. Weber of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. In my 30 years experience in coaching tennis, I've never seen a better tennis training situation for children than Coach Creasy's Total Tennis Training Camps. Chuck Creasy has coached them and trained them in every arena from juniors to collegiate to professional tennis, and over 15,000 children have improved their games at his summer tennis camps. Find out more at chuckcreasy.net. That's chuckcreasy.net.
This is Coach Chuck Creasy. I wanted to ask you to go to my website, chuckcreasy.net, and you can get much more than just how to hit a tennis ball. Folks, I've got my blogs there. I've got every radio show that I've done over the past 3.5 years. Also, my 4 tennis books and actually 2 other books on the history of Clemson athletics. But I have 6 books out there right now and many, many articles for you to read. Also, keep up with my summer tennis camps. Your youngster will learn much more about tennis than just how to hit a ball back and forth over the net. ChuckCreasy.net. Mm-hmm. Making them in America, we are, and we're doing all that we can to keep the challenge great out there for everyone with this sport of tennis. It is the greatest sport ever made, ever invented. We should never dumb it down. We should never minimize it by just trying to make it something popular over something that is powerful. Folks, excellence will always breed popularity, much like Tiger Woods did with golf. And all these young golfers we have coming up now, Tiger Woods, they are the Tiger Woods influence there with his excellence. And we need some of our players to come up and be heroes to our young people again. But excellence will breed participation, but participation does not breed excellence. Folks, I want to talk about team coaching here. I've already been through ABCs of why tennis as an individual sport, tennis as a team sport are different. Yeah, I really do believe we've been barking up the wrong tree and trying to push just the participation part of it over the performance part of it. But in dealing with our players, I wanted to give you something that really it took me about 10 years, probably the mid-80s. I started coaching in the mid-70s, in the mid-80s to learn. And as a young coach, I remember coming in and I had a basketball background and I played tennis in college, but basketball was my true love growing up in the state of Indiana. And I knew the power of teamwork and the power of being on a team, and I loved my college team when I went to college at Tennessee Tech. We had a fantastic, fantastic group of men that stay my friends and brothers until this day, so many years later. But as a young coach, I knew that if you work people hard, they would develop pride. And there were so many things to learn, and I often wondered how they gave me such a job as I got at Clemson University when I was only 25 years old. But I decided to dive in and try to build a team because I knew that if a team worked together and they learned how to really pick up the slack for others when some did not carry their own weight, and then how they learned to stick their nose in the fire together and win together, lose together, suffer together, celebrate together. All those things are incredibly powerful because it's really about the symmetry of many people working together. And I see this always if I'll take my team up, all 13 of my team members up to run together versus two or three to run by themselves. And always the players will run 10 to 15 seconds better in the mile when we run, when they run together, because the team symmetry is just so very, very powerful. So I don't think I have to sell any of you on the importance of teamwork. Teamwork makes the dream work, and any of those catchy sayings. But I wanted to tell you that probably the biggest mistake I made in my first 10 years was I used to fall into the trap of trying to put maybe the wrong people in the wrong position and leadership on our team. For example, team captain, I used to try to put in, as we a lot of times do, the nicest kid or the kid that probably fit into what I thought should be the personality type that I liked, that got along with me the best. And basically, it's two things. You end up having a yes man a lot of the time, somebody that won't tell you the truth on matters. But the other thing is people do not respect just the person who's the conformist. It's sure not, you know, listen, there's nothing against the conformist, but it's, I've always said it's easier to tame a roaring tiger than to inspire a timid pussycat. I would rather have someone committed and doing the wrong thing than somebody just compliant and will never be anything more than compliant doing the right things. The person who's committed and is inspired in their heart doing the wrong thing, I can turn that around. Now, I said before, I don't want to confuse this, I've always said doing the right thing is more important than doing things right. So you might be asking, well, Coach, you're saying here that you'd rather have the person doing the wrong thing the right way. No, doing the right thing is for them to be who they are and to be who God made them in their own personality type. It is not cookie cutter when you're developing people. The biggest mistake a lot of coaches make is they will try, I see this over and over, where a player will play a certain way to a certain level as a player, and then they'll try to coach their kids to play just like they did. And they'll make, if they were an attacking player, they try to make everybody and their sister or their brother an attacking player. If they had certain kind of forehand, they try to teach everybody that same forehand. They'll try to teach their own child that same forehand, just like their style. This is the worst thing you could possibly do. The most important thing to remember is everybody is number one in the world at being themselves. And that is what should be preached from the start. As I have 6 children of my own, all 6 of them are unique and different. I love them all tremendously in different ways, but the point is you've got to do it with your team as well. If you have 10 people on your team, they might have 10 different personalities. They must be allowed to grow to success or grow to failure, being who they are. I am what I am. That's all what I am. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. These things pop into my head, you know. But basically, you are who you are, and that your youngster is who they are, and that has to be nurtured. And this is number one mistake in making a team that works, is trying to feed people into a certain mold, into a cookie cutter compliance. Again, compliance is just step one. You want them then committed, then you want them inspired, and then ultimately you want the reticular activating system locked in to where it is a deep, deep love affair with what they're doing, where they start searching for the answers. I've been preaching recently to my team, guys, work for mastery over your sport. Don't just work for success. Work for mastery, much as if you were going to be a doctor, a brain surgeon, a heart surgeon, where it was really, really important for, you're an engineer, you must work for mastery so that you build this bridge right so that it doesn't collapse one day. In tennis, we need to work for mastery, not just for success. Because, again, doing the right thing is being who you are. Even if being who you are goes against the grain with the coach at first, but you need to have the passion in that heart. Roaring tiger more than a timid pussycat. So there's also, you know, I am what I am. That's all what I am. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. That's number one in the world being you. But the second thing is, I remember my father used to walk around singing this old Bing Crosby song, you know, you got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In-Between. And that was the Andrews Sisters, I think, and Dean Martin. If you want it, go to YouTube, because I've been playing it to my kids lately, and they get quite upset with me, you know, you could imagine. But my father used to play that, and that has the next rule, other than rule number one, being your number one in the world of being yourself. Number two is, yeah, you accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, don't mess with Mr. In Between. And this fits into being who you are, but understanding who you are is very, very important. In about the mid-80s, I was privileged enough for a man to give me these tapes, Fred and Florence Littauer, I believe it was Whole Again Conferences. They need to get the credit for this, but this was fantastic. They put personality types into 4 quadrants. Now look at quadrant 1. For those of you who don't remember your math, quadrant 1 is left top quadrant, or left top window pane, and this was called the sanguine personality are sanguine. Sanguines want fun, creativity, spontaneity, and they are the shoot-from-the-hip people that drive an organized person nuts, but they have fun all day long, and they're mischievous, really, but they're always flying by their seat of their pants, too. To the right, quadrant two, to the window pane right top, is your choleric. The choleric was your personality type that is the control person. Like, you know, I can do, the control person is I'm the person in this room, in this car, that knows what to do, and I can get it right, and, you know, if it's to be, it's up to me type of thing, but they're complete control people. Quadrant number three, the window pane to the right bottom, quadrant number three is called the melancholic, or these are the detail people that believe anything worth doing is worth doing well. Or this is a funny statement that was made. They said, everyone in the world would want to be like me if only they knew how. So these are the detail people that will fold their socks, put their underwear in cases, line up every suit perfectly, comb their hair perfectly. Everything's clean. Everything's detailed. None of these are bad. They're necessarily better than another's. It's just the way that it is. Now, the quadrant four, which is the left bottom quadrant, was called the phlegmatic. Now, these are the peacekeepers, the non-confrontational people. They are internally motivated, but they're externally directed. And they basically control by, they can be non-conformist, but they basically control things by just doing their own thing and not having to be flamboyant. Now, you'll notice a couple things that, for example, a sanguine, okay, let me go around. The sanguine, they used example, the sanguine would be something like the otter, fun-loving, spontaneous. To the right, the choleric or the choleric would be the control freak, would be the lion, you know, king of the jungle. The bottom right quadrant, quadrant three, the melancholic, would be the eager beaver, the beaver, doing it right, working all day, getting it right, doing this right, doing that right. Everything's detail. You could even tell people by their handwriting, can't you? I mean, you ever seen a melancholic versus a sanguine handwriting? But anyhow, I guess people don't do cursive that much anymore, though, do they? That's interesting. They used to analyze personalities based on both based on handwriting. But the beaver would be the melancholic. And then the phlegmatic would be your good old golden retriever. Just a good old golden retriever. All right, now, this has been a cornerstone of my being able to coach teams and trying to make sure that the right people become team captains, the right people have roommates together. Hey, doubles teams, my golly, the two shall become one. You've got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch onto the affirmative. You basically, I will put a sanguine often, a sanguine person who has some choleric in them with the melancholic phlegmatic a lot of times, and it works well. I put the control person with the phlegmatic personality. Opposites attract in marriages often, relationships, roommates. Oh boy, if you room two cholerics together, what the heck you think happens there? The fighting and everything else. And let me talk about doubles teams real quickly. If you put two sanguines together, the top left, the sanguine, they'd get great wins, terrible losses. They're not afraid of, they love to win, they're not afraid of losing enough. You know, and then you've got the cholerics, or the control people. What do you think happens? You put two of those together, they fight the whole time. And if you put two melancholics together, the two detail people, two eager beavers, you know what happens there? They never have a bad loss. They beat everybody they're supposed to, but they always operate with the governor on their engine, too. They never get good wins. The two phlegmatics, if you put them together, those together, the two golden retrievers. Talking about golden retrievers, I've got a golden retriever and a Tennessee tree walker hound. Do you know that that golden retriever just doesn't care? A lot of times he'll give up food, he'll give up attention, he'll give up. He just going along with it. It's the coolest thing ever. But the bottom line, if you put two golden retrievers together or two phlegmatics together, they'd say, who do you want to serve first? I don't care. You want to serve? I don't care. Do you, what do you want? What side of the court you want? I don't care. What do you want? And it's sort of like who's on first type of thing. And it really is interesting. So with your team, there's a couple things here that are really, really important. Number one, people are number one in the world at being themselves. Let them be who they're supposed to be. Let them be who God made them. Now, some people put on a mask and try to please people in a certain way. In other words, let's say you have a phlegmatic youngster and the father's or mother's a very big choleric, and they're always trying to tell the kids, step up, step up, step up. They might fake it and pull it off a little bit, but wearing the mask, it never works out. In the end, you've got to let the sanguine be the sanguine, the choleric be the choleric, melancholic be the melancholic, and the phlegmatic be the phlegmatic. You've got to allow them to be who they are. Now, for example, I've taken this test many times. It's interesting. I've got a test that I'd be glad if folks email me if you want, chuckcreasy.net, or excuse me, what is my email? chuck@coachcreasy.com, chuck@coachcreasy.com. If you'll email me, I'll send you the test. But I've used it for years, and when I take it, it's interesting. I'm almost always a sanguine, overloaded sanguine, some choleric. You have the adjacent where I have some choleric, quadrant one dominant, a little bit of quadrant two. I have a little bit of quadrant four. I have my quadrant three is my weakest area, the melancholic. My golly, if you saw my desk now, you would say, how in the world does this guy get by? But I know sort of where each pile of my stuff is loaded here. I know where to get it. It's just not a melancholic would cringe. But I know this. Now, understand that a person needs to be allowed to be who they are. They're number one in the world at being themselves. And let me talk about the advantages. A sanguine loves game day competition. When you get them on the court and they're ready to go, boy, they're not the people. You'll be trying to get them to take the foot off the accelerator because they want the excitement of the thing. Hard thing is sanguines don't practice well. You've got to give them structure so that they practice well. The choleric people, the cholerics on game day, they try to control things, and it's a tough one. This is important. You know, like, say, Jimmy Connors, McEnroe, those guys were cholerics, and they were able to dominate at the time with those smaller rackets and everything, but I don't see personalities now. Let's see. Gosh, Djokovic has some of that. He's a worker. His work ethic is so good, and he has some sanguine, but yeah, he's probably a choleric. But the point with this is that men's tennis, there are a lot of phlegmatics who are successful. The Sampras's, the Stefan Edbergs, my golly, the Roger Federer's, they are basically in men's tennis, you got to roll with the punches a lot. And if you can get the phlegmatic on the court with the work ethic, with the work done, and you allow them to be who they are, they roll with the punches. They don't have these big up and downs. Folks in women's tennis, if you don't agree, call in, tell me. But in women's tennis, the cholerics do better than the phlegmatics. In women's tennis, those women who are a little bit stronger personality on the court and try to dominate the situation, they usually do better in this sport. I'm coaching a young lady right now who's phlegmatic personality, and boy, it's not going to be her game that's really hard, but it's the other part where she'll go on the court and other people will sort of boss her around, and it doesn't work well. had a great ball striker who was 18 years old a few years back, who was had won a few big championships. And but she made the comment, she says, I just don't like the way it is out there with me. I'm not the bossy personality, and I don't do well with that. Now, do you have to be bossy on the court? No, as a woman. But the point being is this is an observation that I'm just saying is a little bit harder. So you might think about this with your teamwork. So anyhow, personality, these personality traits and the testing is very, very important. I can honestly say it's one of the top five tools that I have ever had in coaching was learning these personality types and the testing. And I'm getting ready to give the guys on my team a test here in the next couple of weeks before Christmas. And I can almost judge ahead of time exactly how they're going to finish with the balance. You take 40 questions on these tests, and I can tell who's going to have the majority in the sanguine or choleric or melancholic or phlegmatic. So accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, latch on to the affirmative, watch out for Mr. In-Between, and that's critical. So a couple things here. The show will go over a little bit here today, but I've got to go through a couple things. In team coaching and motivation, look, in a team situation, I always say there's the three P's are your only tools as a coach for motivation. Number one is peers. Peers. Number two is pain. Number three is pleasure. Peers, pain, and pleasure. These are the only tools you have. Peers, number one. Mama used to say, if you don't want to catch fleas, you don't hang around with dogs. Association breeds assimilation. You become who you hang out with. You've got to get the right culture on your team, and I don't know how to tell you. I don't know your situation. I'll tell you to do this, but ultimately you've got to have people doing the right things. Hopefully your top people are doing the right things and your last people are doing the right thing. Number one and two people are doing the right thing, and your number 10 and 11 people are doing the right thing. It's sort of like the top people are like the engine on the train and the others are like the caboose pushing everybody else, but you've got to have the right things being translated non-verbally as well as verbally on your team. Peers, surround people with the right people. Okay, pain. I've brought this up before. Pain engages the brain. Pain is important. Pain of losing. And as I've been asked so many times, what is the threshold ingredient that is the difference between winning and losing at a high level? The best players hate losing more. That's it. Pain of losing is important. Now, when you supply pain, first of all, in punishment, they don't let you inflict much pain anymore, and this is too bad. I think that it's really critical to be able to have people go run and get the physical pain, turn bad pain into good pain with physical pain, and turn bad pain into good pain with physical pain. Coaches need to be able to do this because the youngster doesn't have to carry it around with them like a big black cloud always hanging over their shoulder. The guilt of doing something wrong must be alleviated. Coaches, don't allow a youngster to carry the guilt of doing something wrong over a long period of time. Reward, pleasure, peers, pain, pleasure. Reward, this is a tough one because kids get so much nowadays that it's hard to give them any T-shirt that they don't have, any racket that they don't have. It's hard to give them anything that they've not always had or experienced before. Participation trophies. When you champion the weak, you weaken the real champions. Also, when you give participation trophies out, the kids don't know the difference between diamonds and rhinestones. Oh, is this a really good award, or is this one of those participation awards, or what the heck does it mean? It doesn't mean anything if there has not been sweat and toil and labor put into the earning of it. So we've really, really diluted, polluted, and prostituted that reward part of tennis. But these still remain the three P's, and you've got to tap into peers, and then the pain at the right time, reward at the right time. A quick little thing about the pain and pleasure. So you have a youngster that is a great person, a great kid, a great trainer, and he loses and he's in agony. All right, so what do you do when a youngster loses and they're a great kid and they're in agony? What you do is you change the bad pain into good pain. You send them on a run. You send them a couple hours later or have them go back to the courts and practice. Now, there's a NCAA rule against doing this right now, and they have completely botched this up in that there's a rule that does not allow the athletes to go back out and practice or train after a match. They think it's cruel and unusual punishment. Well, they don't get it. When you have a team that has a crushing loss, the worst thing you could do is have them smolder like just, you know, an awful, awful disease that you don't get over overnight, and then pretty soon that you have this thing hanging over you for a long, long time, usually for 1 or 2 days. The best thing you do with a good youngster after they have lost a tough match is get them back out on the court, work on something, go take a run. So anyhow, that's really been a botch up by whoever the people are that made those rules. I think it's probably the ITA pushing that one in somehow back a few years ago. But they don't understand the importance of it, and they haven't looked at it that way, I'm sure. If the kid is a youngster is a good kid and they win a big match, so the pleasure, the reward part of it, what you do is you let them sit on it. Do not take them back out to practice. Do not, if they have to, do a short practice late in the evening or something. You let them sit on it and let them feel all of the strength and let them digest it completely. And if they can't digest it, I always say you either got to digest a big win or throw it back up and get rid of it, because you got to be hungry again the next day. But ultimately, a win turns into confidence for the youngster. So the good youngster, you always eliminate the pain with work, turn bad pain into good pain. And with the good youngster, when they win, you help them to digest it into a higher level of confidence in their skill sets. Now, if the youngster is not a kid or not a youngster that you are fired up about their attitude, say they're a bad kid, they're lazy, they don't work hard enough, here's what you do. When they have, just to reverse, when they have a loss, you make them sit on it for 3, 4, 5 days, even a week. I will do this all the time. If somebody has not been working hard enough loses, they'll come out the next day, I want to play that guy again. No, sorry, they're ahead of you now. Oh, no, I want to play this guy. No, you can't. Well, can I play them? No, we got to wait. Can I go to this tournament? No. And what I will do, well, I will let them smolder and burn over the fact that they lost this bad match. And it usually turns around an attitude and changes their altitude as far as the way they look at things. Now, just the reverse is true also with a win or a good result for the bad kid. If somebody comes back and they have had this great win and their attitude is bad, I always get them beat in the next couple hours or the next day. And I get them beat bad. If I get a youngster that comes back and they're really full of themselves and they're doing all the wrong things, I will bring in somebody and get them smoked. And tennis gods, I say, will have their way with you regardless. You better honor the game first, or the game will not honor you. Do you understand? The game will not honor you if you do not honor the game. I've got some other quick things I'd like to go through. We're running out of time here. But use of positive and negative feedback. Again, it's... They don't like you to have negative feedback, but it's really important. Folks, punishment is important. Do you know that if you are a parent and you let your youngster get away with something, it's the worst possible thing you could ever do? If you are a coach and you let a player get away with something that is awful, it's the worst possible thing. It turns into a cancer, and then it really can ruin your whole team and all your teamwork. You don't care about a player if you let him get away with it. As a parent, you don't really care about your child if you do not address that situation. And here's why. It's not about you keeping order as a melancholic. It's not about you having to prove you're the choleric and the big shot in the group or you're the coach. It's the fact that when a youngster has done wrong, they know they have done wrong. And the point is, if they have a conscience at all, they carry around the guilt and the shame of that. And the thing is, punishment allows a clean way to clean up their guilt and their shame. Like doing their penance it's extremely important for a youngster to be able to L-FIDO, learn, forget it, drive on. L-F-I-D-O, learn, forget it, drive on. It's very, very important for them to have that. Positive feedback and negative feedback. Look, couple quick things about competition. Positive feedback should be used before and during competition. When they're out, this is an interesting thing. When your team's out there playing, one thing I've learned over the years is that, familiarity breeds contempt, but familiarity also breeds the wrong, I don't want to say condescending eyes, I want to say eyes of too much scrutiny. As a coach, we always see the negatives much more in our own players than we see the positives in them. We usually see the positives in another player we're seeing for the first time. It's interesting, if a visiting team comes in, they stay for 2 or 3 or 4 days, you'll see them the first day, you say, wow, I wish I had those players on my team. Second day, well, wait a minute, they're not quite that. Third day, hey, my guys aren't so bad ever. The fourth day, it's like, wow, I'm glad I got my guys. And it's the way we look. We only see the negative sometime with our players. But before they're getting ready to play, they are really need to be, if you use any fake reinforcement at all, positive reinforcement before you play, there's never a match we go into that I ever think that, look, I know we're overloaded some, but I always know there's a way to win if the guys do this and this and this and this. So you basically must accentuate the positive before and during matches. Do not use positive feedback for mediocre performance. Do not use positive feedback for bad performances. You need to use positive feedback more for your less experienced players, even though they've played, I always say you're young in school, but you're not young in tennis. Even if they're old in tennis and have a lot of experience, they need a lot of feedback. You'd be endlessly supportive before and during competition. After competition, give them an hour or two before you say anything negative. It's just like a person getting ready to go out and sing the national anthem on stage. The time to be a melancholic, micromanager, paralysis by analysis person. Think about this. When your youngster's getting ready to go out and play the match, realize they're going out and singing the national anthem in front of 5,000 people on stage. That's the way you've got to, and I don't want to pump weak sun. You've got to pump the right sunshine, but basically it's not the time to dismantle. Dismantle in practice days, competitive environment, you reinforce. I always try after losses to try to give more positive feedback after losses. Point out what you could, should, or would have done if you could do it over again. Oh, and it's not fake. It's not lying. It's just things you got to do. Use positive feedback a lot less after winning. Listen, this works really well, but after they win, just so, hey, good job, talk to you later, just let them go. Don't even say anything. Just sort of act like they've been before. I always remembered Herschel Walker never danced in the end zone after he scored touchdowns, and there was a comment that I think he made that his father always used to say, act like you've been there before. And that's what you do with your youngsters. It might be the biggest match of their life, but act like they've been before. Hey, job well done, we'll talk later. They'll get all the feedback from their mom and dad and their aunts and uncles and friends and everything like that. Then you come back to them later and you can say something solid like, very proud of you today because of this and this and this, not because of the win or the loss, but I'm proud of you because of this and this and this. And, but don't get caught up in the hoopla too much, because I'll tell you what, it's a little time to celebrate, no time to cry in tennis. Some days you're picking the grapes, other days you're drinking the wine. It might be Park Avenue, Park Bell. It just flips back and forth so much. Don't throw too big a party when they win. You're the coach. Give them feedback when they need it, but be careful with that. Negative feedback not before competition. Should not be used immediately after competition. I think you've already got that. It works well in practice. In practice, it is all about your side of the court. Game day, they should be focused. I am the constant. The opponent is the variable. It should be, the focus should go to the other side of the court. Once the focus is on what I'm doing right, what I'm not doing right, then you have some serious problems out there on the court. The person looks at their side of the court in game day. Game day, it's the other side of the court. One of the big, big trick on game day is to try to get your players used to seeing the other person's bad and their own good. Negative reinforcement done in private. There used to be an old coaching saying, praise in public, criticize in private. That nothing could be more true than that. Negative reinforcement feedback can be used after a win if the effort is not good. And after losses, it's a great time to learn with your players. I've always said winning should not go to your head, losing should not go to your heart. Winning should go to the heart for confidence. Losing should go to the head for learning. Folks, this team coaching, I think we've explained a lot about it and talked a lot about it. Remember, go to chuckcreasy.net if you want more information. And I hope that you will listen to the show every week, next week as well. Folks, I've run out of time. I got to go.
Made in America, born in a hot land, raised up a family, a King James and Uncle Sam. Semper Fi tattooed on his lip song. Spent a little more in the store for a tag in the back of this USA. Won't buy nothing that he can't fix. With WD-40 and a Craftsman wrench, he ain't prejudiced. He's just made in America.
You're in the process of winning or losing every day of your life, and it has very little to do with a win or loss. And folks, Rockne, look up on the internet, look up the Rockne prayer. It says something like, Lord, for all that I do in competition, and whether it's winning or in losing, he says, help me do it with grace and with honor. It says, and if I should win, let me do it with my honor held high in a humble way. But if I should lose, let me have the courage to stand on the side of the road and cheer as the winners go by. Look up Rockne prayer there, and it's a great one. But folks, team competition, again, it's a wonderful thing. We need it for participation and for learning, but we sure do need the individual tennis tournaments as well so that our players get better. God bless you, and we will see you next week at noon on Wednesday with American Tennis.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.